Hello and welcome to the Interior Design Business. My name is Jeff Hayward and I'm here today with my co-host Susie Rumbold, past president of the British Institute of Interior Design and creative director of Tessuto Interiors, to talk about the thorny issue of charging fees and getting paid.
It's a problem most interior designers are familiar with. You have been given a brief for a lovely project and you quote a fee based on that brief. But then the actual job turns out to be much more complex and difficult than you had expected and nothing like what you had quoted for. Suddenly, the situation is out of control and you're in danger of working for free, losing money or falling out with your client. But what can designers do to protect themselves from goalposts that move and projects that creep? And what steps do they need to take at the start of a project to ensure smooth running further down the track? Welcome to the Interior Design Business.
We are joined by two renowned interior designers, Anna Bells, founder of Run for the Hills, and Andrea Benedettini, founder and principal designer of Andrea Benedettini Interiors. Welcome both to the show.
Thank you.
So before we begin, I wondered if you'd be happy to tell us a bit about what you do and your background in interior design. Anna, would you like to go first with that one?
Sure. Run for the Hills is a combination of myself and my husband, business partner, me and my team, fashion interiors, bars, members clubs, hotels, boutique cinemas, but we also do residential as well. And then my husband's team will design the menus, the sign, the brand, the signage, the wayfinding, the art for those projects. So we're very much a multidisciplinary studio.
Absolutely.
So it's very exciting.
Okay. And Andrea?
Well, I'm the founder of Andrea Benedettini Interiors, and I run an interior design and interior architecture studio in London with my team. We focus on high-end residential projects, mostly in London, but also some abroad. We've got our first project in South of France, which is very exciting. And yeah.
Fantastic. And how long have you both been running your businesses?
So Run for the Hills has been going for, I think, almost 12 years.
Wow. And Andrea?
I founded the studio in lockdown, literally at my partner's home in the countryside, in the coach house. I was actually a freelancer at the time and all my work kind of dried up. And one day I just didn't have any work. And then I got a phone call and my former boss and mentor had a project and it was too small for them. So she passed it on to me.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. Yes.
That was kind of her to do that.
And it was really sweet.
Very kind. Okay, we're going to get straight to it, Anna. Is there more than one way of charging for interior design services?
There are lots of ways to charge. And I'm sure I would be safe to say that we've all tried lots of different ways.
Absolutely.
We are on a regular basis come back to a previous way that we tried a few years ago to see if that works better. We are on a constant cycle of changing the way we do our fees. There is no one size. It never works for all of our clients.
Fixed fees, hourly rates, something in the middle.
So we rarely... It's the holy grail for me. When I meet other interior designers and they say, oh, I do everything on an hourly rate. And I'd say, how do you get your clients to agree to have a never-ending, stretching, wonderful hourly rate? But some people seem to manage that. We've never quite seemed to manage that. On a couple of occasions, we've had a long-term client that we've worked with for years who just trusts us. And then we go on to a little bit of a retainer, a monthly fee. We either use all the time or we don't, but that's very rare. It's normally a fixed price with a bit of scope and wiggle room for extras.
Okay. Andrea?
Well, when we meet potential new clients and we decide that that can be a synergy and therefore like the possibility of a collaboration together, we will go through a few steps and then we will draft a fee proposal. And the fee proposal basically will list all the services that we provide. And it's quite an extensive and comprehensive document. It takes a long time to prepare and it lists all the services and all the tasks that we literally have to go through to deliver the project from concept to completion. Anything that it's outside that fee proposal, it's kind of like an additional for our clients. And we try and be as clear as possible. And we say, look, we've compounded everything in this document, but you know, everything extra will be charged at an hourly rate.
And what are those things that you're listing? What are they, those services?
So the services, we like to think of interior design as layers. So there's various layers to a project. We always start with the first one. It's the interior architecture. And interior architecture will have a couple of phases. So the first phase is a concept phase, then you have a tender pack phase, and then you have a design implementation phase. And within each of these phases, there's lots of different services that go from, you know, preparing the mood boards, doing the technical drawings, doing some beautiful visual renders, selecting all of the finishes. So we try and be very, very accurate, and we list all of the services in the fee proposal just to avoid any miscommunication. And even if you list them, because there's so much information for a new client to take in, sometimes things go missing in translation and clients don't actually read what's there. So you have, it is your job to remind them. And after we send a fee proposal, I always ask them to do a meeting to discuss the fee proposal, because it's such an overwhelming document. Sometimes there's 7 or 8 or 9 pages. And I kind of go through each one of the points, questions that they may have, but also try to reinforce all of the services that we provide.
I don't know. Anything to add?
So we've got lots of different ways that we do it. Same thing. We receive a brief. Let's say it's an email that's come in saying we've got a new cafe or a bar, sushi bar in Soho. And can you give us a fee proposal, please? That's normally the tenor of the email. Okay. So we obviously need to know more about the project. So we'll have a call or a Zoom or a site visit to try and flush out the brief. What do you think you actually need from us? Sometimes they don't know, do they? So you have to kind of almost return the brief. And then we'll try and break it down and think, okay, is this a full service from start to finish? Concept, spatial, all the way through to final styling, opening, training. Is it that proposal? Are they ready for that proposal yet? Or is there a slightly different initial project that we could do with them that actually gets the opportunity to test out how we work with each other, that could be slightly less daunting than the 10, 12, 20 page document? So sometimes it's even in that very moment of the briefing, we're making a decision about how we're going to structure a fee proposal, whether it's a smaller micro project that just gets them the most critical information they need right now. For example, bar restaurant project, they're chasing a site in Carnaby, but there are 4 other really important leading brands that are chasing the same site. Do we just help them with driving out the practicalities and the, you know, the opportunity of that site? How many covers can they get? What's the layout? Does it work? And then maybe some mood boards that gets the landlord excited or whoever they're trying to win the site from. Do we just do that? And is that a few days? Is that a couple of weeks consultancy? However many days it might be. Do we just do that to test out how we work together? Or do we give them the full fat proposal for our involvement all the way through the design process?
Because I'm not sure that sometimes clients actually read to the end of a 12-page fee document. They'll just turn to the bottom page and go, bottom line, too expensive, bin.
Absolutely. And you don't know, this is the thing that happens all the time, you don't know if they are comparing apples with apples with other design studios. Obviously, occasionally a project comes along, they just want you, they've seen your work, they love what you do, they're not talking to anyone else. So it's about a contract negotiation in a way, isn't it? It's coming to the right figure. But often we're in a pitch type situation where there are some other really cool agencies that are also bidding for the job. We're all asked to give a proposal, a costing, and they'll just say, well, you're more expensive than the others. And so we'll just need to then say, well, can we go through it? Or can we talk to you about how you've read it? Is it like for like? Is it apples for apples? Has the other agency costed for CGIs, for example? Have they costed for, you know, a full tender specification for all of the different room variants of a hotel? Or have they just given the overall concept design? But you have to dig into it, because often it is not apples for apples at all. And sometimes, in the same way that, you know, how builders like to lowball the fee and then it grows throughout the life of the build, but to win the project, that happens too. Whereas I think we tend to be quite thorough, because we want it to be clear from the outset how much care we will put into the deliverables and to do a really professional service. But it does mean we lose the job sometimes on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Andrea, fixed fee, client accepts, but then there are lots of things, lots of grey areas that can come about during a project. So, I mean, the kind of issues that you face, just talk about some of those. What is the challenge for you?
Well, we're quite clear with our proposals and the way we work. I pride myself to be as transparent as I possibly can. And we explain to our clients, for example, that they have 2 rounds of revisions per phase. And, you know, anything beyond that will have to be charged as an additional obviously, as a business owner, there needs to be a degree of flexibility. And if a client asks for an extra revision, sometimes you're going to do it because you just want to keep the project moving. But then, you know, that is in place because if a client starts taking advantage of you, then, you know, you can go back to the contractor and say, like, look, we can draw as many options as you want, but this takes time, you know. The biggest misconception that I think people have is that design doesn't take a long time. And, you know, we can just whip out like a new design scheme during the night. And it's really not the case. It takes a lot of consideration, a lot of thought, and then, you know, a lot of design work. So we have that kind of thing in place. And as a business owner, it's sort of like our responsibility to make sure that we are on track with the hours, we're not spending too much time on a project, and just keep that line of communication open. The best thing that you can do is spot these little red flags as they come about, and you notice that the client wants you to do something that was not included in the scope, and then you just go back to them and say, like, look, we can do it, like, anything is possible, but there will be a fee attached to that. Are you okay to pay that? And then we will do it. The worst thing that you can do is just go ahead and do it, and then 2 months down the line go back to the client and say, oh, actually, we did a lot of extra work, this is the invoice. It's just not going to go down well.
It drives them crazy, yes, doesn't it? And they don't want to pay, and it gets, yeah, in the way of the relationship. Although it can happen when you're busy. And with the best will in the world, everyone's busy and everyone's servicing, and the team, obviously, quite right, you want to keep the clients happy. You might be out on site one day, you might be, and you know, the team want to please and want to help if there's a situation. So it does happen, doesn't it? And it's a real grey area. It's interesting, actually. So I find with residential projects, it's easier to control the rounds of changes. Still not always possible, and we still make errors, and we realise we've done a lot more, or we've imagine that we would be expected to design that joinery piece, but actually on this specific project they didn't pay us to do that, but you wouldn't normally would on a project. So if those little miscommunications can happen within the team, and that can be tricky when the client doesn't want to pay. But we do find that on a commercial project, a bar or a restaurant or a hotel, it's very hard to stay within two rounds of changes on a general arrangement floor plan, you know, for five restaurants on the ground floor of a huge hotel. It often takes an iteration G, H, whatever, I find, to get to the right layout once everybody's who needs to have a hand in it has looked at it from operations. So it's tricky, isn't it?
Do you always just say two rounds of revisions, though? Or would you, in an instance like that, say, actually, for this phase of the project, actually, I'm going to put in fee for four revisions?
Yeah, so we do sometimes vary it. And I think particularly at that general arrangement, then you can start running around all the rest of the plans through once everything's been fixed or frozen. But it's also key, isn't it, to then have a point at which that drawing is frozen. Mm. And there's an understanding that beyond that point, fees would kick in. Still not easy.
Yeah.
Even if you've put it in the fee proposal 1,000 times and you've even highlighted it in yellow, underlined it, it still comes as a bit of a shock to our clients sometimes.
And Andrea, what happens when you have time delays on a project? No fault of yours, but again, that can push back onto you. That means you have to allocate more time to the project.
Yeah, time delays are a tricky one because especially for a small business, they can have an impact on our cash flow, for example, and they can have an impact on the project. Like from a creative perspective, like time delays, I think they block the creative flow of a project, and they can actually stop our designers to really like fulfill their design intent and like be their exceptional designers. Time delays can affect our cash flow because we're meant to go into the next phase, and then we're meant to invoice the next phase, and then we're not getting cash within the company. And then often with the time delays, clients get really frustrated and they don't fully understand maybe who's causing the delay or what impact will the delay have on the overall project. And it kind of is our job. Everything kind of falls onto the interior designer because the interior designer is the visionary, is the leader of the project. You know, there's lots of different components and different specialists that work in the project, but I really find myself as being like the leader of all of my projects. And it's kind of our job to explain to the client as soon as this is one of the red flags that I see popping up like every other day. And you just have to draft an email or pick up the phone and keep that line of communication really open and explain to them this time delay will have an impact on your storage storage costs for the warehouse, because the FF&E has to be in storage for a longer period of time. Yeah. Or it will have an impact on the production of the joinery and the installation of the joinery, because the joiners are booked for another job. And
you products can, that go out of stock, for example, because of the delay.
100%. Or prices that go up because there is going to be a price increase. And, you know, you just have to be honest and you have to keep the line of communication open all the time.
It's really, really tricky, though, isn't it? Because the client doesn't perceive that it necessarily should be at their cost to pay. I think they might understand the storage, they might understand the lead times, they might understand those things. But, for example, we have, some restaurant projects. The landlord has caused, the overall overarching landlord has caused some of the delays, which means that the project has finished stage four. Everyone's got to their sort of tender pack, but we're not at stage five yet because we can't go on site yet. But obviously the project is continuing and meetings are happening and things are being discussed. And it's that stretch, which the client is, you know, would quite rightly feel is tough for them to cover with extra design fees. But you're still talking about the project, aren't you? So stretch is a real challenge.
Mm. And also, when you get beyond that point and you get to the stage where actually you're on site and you're doing your on-site supervision, and you may have allowed for X number of site visits or days or whatever it might be across a period of time, which was the original budget, you know, the forecast program, and then the thing goes on for another 3, 6, 9 months, how do you then go about capturing all those extra sites? Because you still have to keep turning up every week.
Of course you do. So again, I think, you know, in the past we've tried a sort of site attendance fee, let's say, for that stage. So you've delivered your tender pack, you've gone through value engineering, and there's a certain amount of time associated with that, which again also often overruns, doesn't it? Particularly when pricing is kind of tricky at the moment and supply chain. When we get to that phase where it's on site and obviously you're receiving RFIs, requests for information, emails, WhatsApp groups, whatever's going on, it's very hard to manage actually that amount of time based on what they find and what happens on site. And that, you're right, Susie, if it stretches, is it the same monthly site attendance fee? Is it slightly less? Does it go on longer? It all needs negotiating, doesn't it? But it can be tricky in the moment to always capture it in the moment. I think it sounds like you're hyper-organised, actually. I don't think I'm quite as organised, and sometimes a month might go by and we realise, oh gosh, actually there is stretch going on. But then it's very difficult to go back to a client after the effect to ask for money.
Yeah.
Really tricky.
Mm. So from the offset then, how do you go about determining what the client actually needs? And how important is that, taking that first brief? Andrea?
I mean, our job is to read people's minds sometimes. It really is. And it's all in the nuances. And it's all, like, it really is that kind of sensitivity that you need to have as an individual, as a professional, to perceive all these nuances that a client has that might not be able to articulate. So, you know, we spend a lot of time with potential new clients. And as I said before, there is a bit of a process before we even start thinking about drafting a fee proposal. We do a chemistry call at the beginning, and then we do a discovery meeting, whether it's a design studio or whether it's on site. We really want to get a feel for who these people are. Are these people a good fit for the company? Are we going to work well together? Do we share the same values? And then, you know, once we've drafted a fee proposal, we'll start talking about the brief and their vision. And, you know, sometimes clients come to us with a really clear vision and they just need us to
facilitate,
make it happen. And sometimes clients come to us because they've seen our previous work and they like our style and they want to, you know, they want a project that looks like one of our previous projects in a way. But sometimes clients are not entirely sure what they want, and you just have to kind of read in between the lines and help and develop the design language that will be carried out through the project. I always tell our clients, we need to work a lot on the brief, because a project without a brief and a strong concept, it's a project that it's going to fail. It's not going to be successful.
And it will get in the way of the relationship, won't it? We find that, I find that pictures speak 1,000 words. So you can talk around the brief, what the client might want, the deliverables back from us that they might want. But actually, I've found over the years that to visualize it for them really helps them hone it down to what they want. So, for example, I've got a document that shows the different levels of joinery drawing, from a sketch level version to a full working drawing to us red penning a shop drawing from a contractor. And they'll have a very emotional reaction to, well, that's the one I want, or I'm fine with that one. And then actually that's a very different fee proposal that you would put together for a sketch level joinery design rather than a full working drawing where everything's, you know, plan view, side view, sectional details. So I've just tried to visualize the level of detail in a drawing pack, for example, which is a big part of our design fee, is the huge number of technical drawings that you need to do on a project. So trying to understand the level that they want, how detailed, and if there's a project architect, that can have a difference, can't it, to the theme as well?
Completely.
So there's so many variables to how you even go about doing a costing before you even do the costing. Try and flesh that out.
So defining those project deliverables.
And the nuance within those, each of those, is just takes a lot of time, doesn't it? And sometimes doing a first round of, so actually sometimes what we'll do is return the brief in a detailed form, have that chemistry meeting. Maybe we capture the notes in AI so that it's really captured what was said and it's proven. I don't know if you've tried that.
We use
an AI companion called Fathom, and it's really great. So if anyone hasn't checked out Fathom, try it. You do have to pay for it, but it's better than the inbuilt one to Zoom. And it's video and it captures in a pithy bullet point way what was said, what was discussed, what was needed. So you can always go back to it. But then we'll return the brief in minute detail. We think what you're asking for is the full Reba design stage process, let's say, but within that it's, you know, X number of GAs, X black and white elevations are not rendered, CGIs or not CGIs, 3D model or not 3D model, full FF&E specification through to tender, or just concept design pack to be handed over to the project. So we'll just try and in a minutiae create a list of deliverables for the client to then come back and say, that's absolutely it. Although, or they'll say, no, there's something you've forgotten. Or
do you need to understand the project procurement route up front? Because if it's design and build, then obviously the information that the designer is producing is a completely different order of magnitude to full service.
Yeah. So in most of our instances, it's not D&B. So we are the ones creating that drawing pack that then gets built upon by specialists like specialist joiners, or the contractor might do some shop drawings of the bar, or the gantry, or the most complicated joinery piece. But we are actually originating an awful lot of the drawing pack. But you're right, it can vary, can't it, according to the project. So you do need to have those discussions up front. And on the FF&E side, you also have to have the discussion about whether you're going to be handling the procurement, or certainly the development of this pack of finishes and FF&E to pro forma invoice stage, which again is a huge amount of work.
Mm. I feel like you are very flexible in the way that you work with your clients. And I think like kind of maybe reflects like your style and the way you are as a person. It's really like it's inspiring to see. I'm definitely like a lot more regimented the way.
This is how it is.
This is how it is, because I like to be in control. I find that when clients start getting in the way of taking control over a project, things just end up going wrong. I know that when I'm in control, things will be fine. And, you know, we've finessed a way of delivering a project that I feel like incredibly comfortable with. And I like to do to produce the rendered elevation, for example, because I know that that's the point where the clients will go like,
see it.
Wow,
get excited.
Clients often don't read line drawings. They don't understand it. I know that I need to do the procurement of, well, the studio has to do the procurement of the furniture, because when we go into the detail phase of the procurement, that's when we really get into the nitty-gritty of the details of all of the bespoke upholstery pieces that we've designed. A client can't do that. Mm-hmm. They're just going to buy a piece off a shop and it's not going to have the same nuances and details that we would design for them. So I kind of, it's true that there needs to be a level of flexibility in pricing a project. And sometimes, for example, with a project in France, we couldn't do a fee proposal that had everything in it to begin with, because we didn't know if the project was going ahead, because there was so much planning involved. The house had to be knocked down and rebuilt. So we just did a fee proposal for the floor plans to begin with, and then eventually took on the whole project. But usually we try and be as comprehensive as possible, because this is what we are. This is who we are. We are an end-to-end interior design company that will look after you from the very beginning of the project until we hand you the keys. So, and we like to kind of be in control and deliver that.
It is a tricky one, because sometimes, as Anna, you were saying, you could just do a feasibility study for somebody And that can work really well. But actually, people are trying to pin down their costs. So they actually do want the fee. They do want to understand what the total fee is going to be, because they've probably got an architect's fee and an engineer's fee and a possibly a lighting designer fee and any number of other fees.
But we actually often extend our feasibility study to include some of that FF&E QSing. So we are giving them an idea of the cost. So, for example, it's more likely we would do that on a residential project, but we would do a more encapsulated project initially to drive out, let's say, the vision, some floor plans, an overall look and feel to get everybody excited, but then straight into the number crunching. Based on these floor plans, based on these ideas, here are the things we can help you cost, because you've got your QS looking at the build, you've got your builder giving you some costs, you've got your project architect possibly mapping out their involvement. But we know from this look and feel, which gives us a bit of an idea of a benchmark in terms of where we're going, these floor plans in these rooms times 20 in the house or 10 in the house or 5 in the house are X number of products, and we work it through until we would go back to them with a, it's going to cost you in the range of this. And if you look at the window treatments, it's an estimate. We haven't got curtain makers in necessarily to do the quotes yet, but based on hunch experience, you're looking at probably a budget of X to X for those. So then we put that together, which is, bolted onto the creative deliverables and the technical deliverables. It's still quite an encapsulated project, but then you put that figure next to your build and your architect. And my point being that if I don't ring fence enough for the beautiful project that you really want to buy into, that's why you've come to us, you'll spend all your money with the architect. You'll spend all your money with the builder.
And in the mid,
and then you will leave us with very little.
And at the end, the client will be sitting on the floor in the middle of a muddy puddle.
Or like a grand design, where you see the program and it's amazing, it's so exciting. And then you go for the walk around at the end and it's so underwhelming.
Yeah.
Because not enough money was left for...
Oh, completely. Yeah.
We try and be like super upfront about the FF&E budgets for a project. Because we supply the furniture, we know how much things cost, and we tell the clients for a project of this size, if you want to do a full FF&E pack, this is how much you need to spend.
Can you give them a cost per square foot, or do you actually work it through in terms of
a little bit of both? So if it's a full project, we will do a cost per square foot, and there is a little bit of a spectrum depending on the level of detail and layering that you want to achieve. But if it's a slightly bittier project, for example, we're not doing the whole house, then we will go into slightly more detailed approach and will cost room by room based on previous projects, which takes a little bit more time for us, initial stages of the project, but at least the client has a budget. And I found that it's best for them to have all the figures and to know how much you're going to spend, because you're going to filter out the clients that they can't afford the project.
Sure.
How much do you know? How do you price each of those deliverables?
So there's two different things, aren't there? So I guess that QSing and scoping, we would charge a consultancy rate to pull together those costs and those budgets. It's a feasibility study, effectively. When it comes to the actual design deliverables, let's say the doing of floor plans, mood boards, sketches, CGIs, model making, FF&E palettes, finishes, an FF&E scheme. It's literally using your gut instinct, looking back at previous projects. How much time did we spend on Riva stage 1, 2, 3, 4? The schedule stage versus the tender pack stage. Try and use some of those principles to estimate the time that we might think it will take, the number of people in the team, seniority, and come to a, sometimes it's a range price. I'll go in with a range price, rather it's between this and this for stage 3 or stage 2. I won't actually give a fixed price at that point, because I kind of feel like maybe we haven't quite had enough of the brief yet, or I don't quite know the level of detail. So sometimes I'll make it range prices, and I guess it's based on those estimated prices that we will then fix, but with these caveats that list the rounds of changes. And in good faith, the opportunity to discuss an uplift if we need to.
And that's why I think your idea of having, is it a sketch design? Is it a detailed design? Is it a super detailed design? Are you just checking the joiners' drawings? If you know that up front, exactly, you can factor in the time that you need to invest in that. Andrea, how do you do yours?
We kind of know what we're going to do in terms of tasks and the services that we provide for each phase, and we we estimate the amount of hours that it's going to take. It's really that detailed. We look at every area, for example, a living room, and we go through all of the tasks that the design team will have to go through, like looking at design concepts, preparing the line drawings, designing the paneling, for example, sourcing the fireplace, specifying the finishes of the floor, of the walls, and then sourcing the furniture and doing all the fabric schemes. And we kind of compare it to previous projects that we've done, and we make a guesstimate of how long it's going to take. Once that figure is locked in for me, that is it. If we spend a little bit more, it's part of the game. The most important thing is that the bulk of the information is there and the hours are there.
And when you've got that total fee, how do you sense check that to make sure you've got everything covered? What's your process?
I compare it to the overall cost of the project and like whatever the client is spending. So I will do a breakdown. I love a spreadsheet. I will do how much are they spending on the build, how much they're spending on the joinery, how much they're spending on the FF&E, on all the consultants that they have on board. And I will do an estimate based on my experience of previous projects. And then I will compare my fee to that and see where it sits. And if I feel like it doesn't sit well, I will try and look at ways to reduce it or maybe like to up it. It depends.
Indeed. Okay.
And I'll just follow my gut.
Okay.
Anna?
I don't do it anything based on percentages. I don't look at the project overall. Obviously, if it's a high-end project or if the client's prepared to do an awful lot of architectural work and they clearly have more budget, I might consider that. But we've had a few projects that were smaller, but fabulous. And they were probably going to win us an award. And they were really cool spaces. And they were for a client that we just really liked. But they weren't a whole renovation, let's say. But they were a very lovely FF&E scheme with inevitably we would then put more joinery in and decorative stuff. But if you looked at the actual spend that they were going to, you know, to spend, let's say, on just the works, that wouldn't cover the volume of what we were going to do for them. So actually I just try and think what do they need from us and how do we put a value on that? Obviously, if a client's got a bigger budget, then you know you can stretch your fees more. If a client's got a smaller budget, we might need to be a bit smarter about how we do things to offer value and to front load the fees in the area that we know we can't shortcut, if that makes sense. So we have such a different range of projects, and some of more comfortable design fees wise, we're comfortable about any little changes and amends. It's all fine because, you know, we've got quite a nice design fee. Other projects are quite tight and it really can feel really tricky when things start moving, and it's everything and anything in between. So it's tricky. Just thinking ahead as well. So we've been talking mainly about design fees, haven't we? But we do also need to talk about actual procurement, don't we, of FF&E and how that works in terms of cost to the client or how that works. And I'm obviously a registered BID designer, passionate about being open book and transparent. And you know, so we are super transparent about our trade discounts and we pass them on in full to our clients and we charge for the service of doing procurement for our clients. And we have so for example, we will mark up the trade price of we'll negotiate the best price we can, and then we'll add a percentage on for the activity of negotiating that price, but we pass on the trade discounts. And then obviously sometimes clients don't want to do that. They'd rather procure themselves or get someone in their team if they've got a company or a business. So we've had lots of issues over the years with not being in control. And I think for me, I do like to be as in control of the whole process as possible all the way through. But the one that really you can't cede control on is procurement. It's anyone else doing it other than your military team. It's a disaster, isn't it? And if a client chooses to do it or get a PA to do it, they have so many issues. They just can't do it. It's really complicated and you have to be so methodical, don't you? So we've started having to have more firm agreements about this. If a client wants to do procurement in a slightly different way, that we charge on an ad hoc basis, and that's where we do get them to agree an hourly fee for any consultancy or WhatsApp group or the kind of craziness that can emerge from a client trying to do procurement or a PM trying to do procurement. Because where you or I would have procured, let's say, so it's not a custom design, but it's a sourced item, it's a beautiful lamp. It goes out of stock. Of course it does. you and I would just find it on another supplier website, or we would think of something different that's very inspired by the original. We would just sort that out. There would be no need for discussion about it. Someone else procuring can't make any of those decisions, and we'll say, it's out of stock, what do I do?
Mm.
So lots of issues.
Yeah. And how do you go about building flexibility into your fee proposals to cover these kind of unforeseens? I mean, Anna, you've just touched on some, but Andrea, do you have any other thoughts?
Well, I think there needs to be a degree of flexibility when you take on a project and, you know, when you work with a new client. It's just, for me, it comes down to monitoring the process and monitoring how the project kind of unfolds and just seeing if that level of flexibility is fair for us or not. So at the beginning, when you price a project, you just use your knowledge and you to the best of your ability. And, you know, you might make a little bit of a loss, but then, you know, you end up with a beautiful project. And as Anna said, you get it photographed, you might win an award. So, you know, everything has a weight.
Mm. Or certain sectors of the segments of the project make money. Others fly by the seat of their hands sometimes, don't they? Okay. But then it kind of comes back in the end. It's interesting. Has anyone else felt the sort of scope creep of WhatsApp groups on projects? And what are you kind of doing about that? They can be incredibly time consuming, distracting.
We push back against WhatsApp groups. It's fine to say I'm running 5 minutes late for the meeting, but WhatsApp groups are generally dangerous, and your PI insurers hate them. So the best thing you should always do is just go, fantastic, thanks very much, I'll reconfirm that back to you on an email. Don't
because
use WhatsApp.
Not covered. It's the not PI covered. Insurance, that's such a great.
They can be deleted. You know, they can be altered. It's not a final. It's not a final record. It's not a permanent record of what the discussion was.
It's not a professional way of operating.
No, I couldn't agree.
I really don't like WhatsApp. All my WhatsApp groups are muted. I mean, I check them, but I don't want to use WhatsApp as like a business tool. Emails are there for a reason. If you need us, you email me. And, you know, if there is an emergency, of course, you can WhatsApp me, but I wouldn't go back to WhatsApp to like find something that we've discussed. It's just so time consuming.
Would you therefore put that in your fee proposal? Do you say, you know, we'll communicate with you on email between these hours? Do you kind of set your client boundaries?
We do set our time boundaries, although sometimes clients don't think about the time boundaries because, you know, for clients, their project is a little bit of an extra thing that they do on their spare time. So for us, it's work, you know. And so, of course, I get a text at 10 p.m. talking about like a curtain pull or, you know, like the wrong tile in the bathroom, because this is the time that clients have to, you know, they come back home from work, they relax and they think about these things and they will WhatsApp you. But it comes down to me to having to choose whether I deal with this right now or whether I deal with this tomorrow. So we do say that our operating hours are from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. weekdays, but, you know, that won't stop everyone, I don't think.
I mean, we do the same. We'll try and encourage the team, even if you get that text late at night, just go back at 9 a.m. Store it. You know, you might consider your response, but go back at 9 a.m. You have to try and manage that behavior.
It was really hard. Like for me at the beginning, it was so hard. When I set up the business, I was so excited. I really wanted to help, and I would reply to every single text late at night. But, you know, you have to put some boundaries in place.
Sounds to me like a detailed fee proposal is a lot of effort. Is it worth it?
Not always. And sometimes it's so dispiriting. You've spent so much time. Sometimes I will have spent 4 days on a big proposal. I'll have pulled in members of the team. I'll have worked with my husband, Chris, on it. We've put a lot into trying to win that project, make it really thorough. And then, of course, it doesn't go your way. The project doesn't happen. They extend it. They delay it. Someone else gets it or lowballs the design fee. And it can feel so dispiriting in that moment because you've had to work late, you've had to come in early the next day to accommodate it. But once the initial hurt's gone, because, you know, we're all emotional creatures, aren't we? We're not dealing with widgets here. It's, you know, we're designers, we're emotional. Once I've got over that shock, I just have to reconcile it to myself that it will always be useful at some point in the future because another project will come along where the thinking that you did for that particular project can be reused again. And then it makes it a quicker proposal that you might be able to do for someone else.
And obviously, if you do win it, it's the basis of contract, right?
A very important basis of the contract, and you have to constantly revisit it. So we had an instance, for example, a few months ago when the client suddenly dropped a kind of very nice newsy email, but it was like, when are we going to get the CGIs? But we'd had big discussions in the early and design fee stages that they didn't want to pay for CGIs. I said, I think they're really important. You get a better finish. Everyone, including the contractors, know what the vision is. Didn't want to. And I put it on every single page, thank God, of the fee proposal. So I just had to send it back highlighting those. This does not include if you'd like to add them. And we know you don't want them if you'd like to add them at a later stage. But thank goodness I'd done that on many pages. I think even just one small print wouldn't have been enough. The client might have said, oh, that wasn't fair. So again, it's thinking that they don't remember the fee proposal. And even sometimes we don't remember all of the detail of our fee proposal.
And they may not have understood it. They really might not have understood what you meant by certain terms,
yes.
Which is why I think, to go back to your point, Andrea, you're having this meeting where you actually go through it with them so that they really get what it is that you're going to give them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important.
It's visiting the fee proposal as well, isn't it? So actually what we sometimes also do, because scope can creep, but to just keep momentum. So sometimes we will revisit the scope, let's call it the scope of works rather than just the fee proposal, but it's the stages of work, isn't it? And what we're completing. And sometimes we will literally color code all the things that are complete so that the narrative, you can see that we're halfway through the project. This is what's coming next, but we'll actually send a visual representation of where we are on the project rather than just an email summary.
Mm-hmm. I think you, Andrea, mentioned freezing things. Or was it you, Anna? I can't remember. Somebody, yes.
You've got approval on a layout. I don't think it's enough to just say that. We've found it's not enough to just say that's approved. You need to make sure it's in writing that it's approved. You need to make sure that on the drawing issue, the title block of the drawing, it says approved. Or we've just started using the word frozen because we feel actually that's far more descriptive of the fact that a change beyond a frozen drawing is clearly a change request. But also just to try and identify and educate clients that if you then change things, let's say in the middle of REBA stage 3 to a GA, a general arrangement from stage 2, it has a knock-on effect to everything.
Mm.
The joinery drawings.
The elevation
drawings, the elevations, the absolutely everything. It's not a small change. Mm. It may feel like a small change to the client, but actually it's a huge change to us and the contractors.
Do you find that as a common problem, that you've got clients who change the scope of things or interfere with that?
It really varies. Some clients are so straightforward, they're happy to roll with the punches and they really follow your lead. And, you know, there might be this slight adjustment here and there. But some clients are really indecisive. Some clients are a little neurotic, they're a little controlling, they're overthinkers. And I've had situations where we submitted a tender and the client comes back to us and says, I want to change the whole floor plan of the first floor. And that will have a knock-on effect, as Anna said, to all the interior elevations, the lighting plan, the floor finishes plan, the arts, everything. And, you know, everything can be done, but, you know, there is a cost associated to it. Once the layouts are approved or frozen, then, you know, they are frozen. We have to progress with the project. And often clients, I find that as long as you are transparent with them and communicative with them, they will understand.
It's all about characters, isn't it?
It really is an individual thing. It varies from person to person.
So hold your ground.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you've frozen something and you've made that clear to the client that you've frozen it at that point, of course they can come back and change their mind if they have that 3 o'clock in the morning epiphany. But it also, REBA recommend not only going back to sort of say, well, we've done all this work, we'll need to redo it, this is the fee to redo it, but also to recommend to advise the client how much extra time that will take. This is X cost and so much delay. And often they might turn around and say to you, do you know what we had was pretty good, I'm going to back off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the knock-on effect could affect the program, mm-hmm. the builders, everything on the project, couldn't it? And obviously time and cost and not moving into the property or extending your lease somewhere you're renting. So it has a huge amount, doesn't it? All of it.
Andrea, how can you guard against over-delivering? How do you stop yourself giving up time that you really shouldn't?
As we discussed before, obviously we are designers, so we're really passionate about what we do. We love what we do. And I think it's within every designer's nature to just over deliver and to finesse things to the point that are like beyond perfect. So as a business owner, as a team leader, it is my job to just monitor the amount of time that we're spending on the project and just monitor the hours with timesheets, like really simple things, going back to basics, check your timesheets and, you know, make sure that we are delivering things that are included in the scope of work or the fee proposal, and anything that is additional or extra, you know, and needs to be raised as an additional if we feel like that is the right thing to do.
Same for you, Anna.
It's really tough. It's really tough because I think, you know, the team want to do great work. And sometimes, let's say if it's something's new, they've not designed a really intricate gantry before. You know, it's so easy to spend a lot of time that might be exponentially not the amount of time that we've put in the design fee. So it's a constant juggling act, isn't it, of understanding that sometimes people need to learn and to be trained and to be mentored. And also we do want it to be great. So obviously, if there's anything that we feel we haven't quite cracked, you take all of that time on you take that as a hit because you need it to be correct. If we've made any sort of error, of course you correct it all at your own cost, isn't it? But it's a constant, it's really difficult. And I find myself, and I hate hearing myself, you know, say so often to the team, let's just check on the time. Let's look at the, so we use a time sheeting software called Tick. And it's so useful and it can give you some absolutely eye-watering results. Sometimes it's like, wow, it just, that stage took so long. Or even just those two elements of that stage, 50 emails later on one poof, you know, between the client, the upholsterer and the issues of the, you know, delivery and dispatch. So it's really tricky between wanting to be creative, what the scope of work's fee proposal is, and the reality,
the commercial reality, actual
reality of dealing with projects. So it's I'd say that hats off to all of us actually that do design as a business. It is a very tricky one to make really good money on, and you have to be so constantly checking and trying to sense check how much time you spend.
One thing that I find that helps me is drafting a program for the project and set the deliverables and the date
where to stretch.
Exactly. So we know from the very, very beginning, we will draft the program and we will set the deliverables and our client meetings. So we know that on that day, we're meant to be finished with the pack of work. And on that day, we're meant to be finished with the other pack of work. So we monitor it a little bit better, but obviously every project is unique and there's so many factors that come into play in stretching the program and so you kind of have to be on it. Like I actually block out time in my calendar every week to do a program check of all of our projects to make sure that if anything has changed within the program, then our deliverables have changed, and then I check the time sheets of the team.
That's really interesting.
I mean, it's a huge amount of time, isn't it? I don't always have, I might be pulled in 1,000 directions. I find it tricky to do that on a weekly basis. But I know, I mean,
I put aside some hours. And as we were talking before, this is the non-sexy stuff that you kind of have to do as a business owner that I really never signed up for, because at heart, I'm an interior designer. I love to design. I want to get my head stuck into a project. But, you know, it kind of comes with a territory and you have to do it and you learn to do it. I'm a little bit of a perfectionist. So I actually now somehow enjoy the programming and the checking, and I find some sort of satisfaction in doing that as well.
Also, it's making a successful business, isn't it? So sometimes I think I like to flip it the other way around. You know, if you just look at the data, the Tick data, let's say, oh gosh, okay, we were great. We were within time, let's say, for Reba Stage 2. The concept mood, I crank out the mood boards because it's what I do and I don't need to spend ages on them. It's whatever. The CAD we were fine at too, but oh, Stage 3, it started to drift a little bit. We're not making as much money on Stage 3. But sometimes I think when you've got a defined task, let's say, to just hothouse it. So don't just capture the time after it's been done. Actually start out at the beginning of that task to say, why don't we just have three of us and why don't we just go in there and sketch some of these bar joineries, you know, but set yourself an amount of time to do it rather than seeing how long it took in retrospect, so that you're kind of trying to vary the way you do the work as well, which can actually refresh patterns as well.
Yeah,
hothousing little blitzing things together rather than one person angsting over something for a whole week on CAD.
Yeah.
How is the behaviour of commercial clients typically different to private residential clients in these respects?
I would say that sometimes a commercial client is less emotional or concerned about the money in the budget. That's not to say that they want the budget to extend or increase or anything, but it's not their money. So sometimes it depends on the level of client that you have on the residential side, but sometimes it is a lot of money. It is a lot of money for them. So they're very anxious about it, you know, and you know, you feel a great sense of responsibility. You feel less of that on a commercial project. As long as you're delivering your part of the project and the FF&E and the finishes levels of budgets on target, you're doing the right thing. But I'd say that actually the differences are fewer than maybe I might have thought 5 or 6 years ago. And I find that scope creep, project stretch, not being able to land on a decision, which I used to think was much more a residential client issue. You know, you get some, as you say, that just know exactly, or they don't know what they want. But when they see it from you, they go, I love that. Let's go with option A, or with a slight tweak from the B palette. Others just can't land. I think I like it one day, next hour, then I come back full circle. But I do find that that can happen on commercial projects.
That's terrible.
Or we find that, for example, the very important people who need to have their eyes on the drawing pack much earlier in the process, which is written into all of the scope of works in our agreements, and we talk about it all the time. We raise it in meetings constantly. I feel like a broken record. It's essential that the operational team and the F&B team look at this GA before we move on to the next stage, for example. It's essential that the kitchen designers don't leave their kitchen, sorry, the kitchen, the bar kit, the bridges, that they don't leave that design till after stage 4 or the tender pack. It should be being integrated at the end of Riva stage 2. We've done our GA, we've set the shape, all these kind of things. But it's amazing how often it does not work like that. And it doesn't matter how many, and this is where I'm left thinking, how am I talking Japanese? Am I talking, you know, even though it's in all the documentation, I raise it at every single meeting and I write emails about, and I try and find different ways to talk about it, it still ends up happening. And then the operational team possibly are just looking at the drawings after stage 4. And then, of course, then you're into change variations, and it can just get in the way of a relationship that's been an amazing relationship. And then suddenly those change requests are difficult to manage. Also because the program has a cost. So it's very tricky.
So don't be complacent.
You can't ever be complacent, ever, can you? It's constantly revisiting, constantly revisiting.
Andrea, have you got any top tips for getting paid on time?
You know what? I think the world, the country, we're going through a very difficult, challenging political and economical climate. And, you know, even at the top tier of high-end residential projects, I think we're starting to feel it. And invoices often don't get paid on time. So I've become what I call a professional chaser. And, you know, if invoices are not paid within the time frame that we allow them to be paid, then interest will start applying. Obviously, we remind our clients, if we get to the point, we remind them, and usually the invoice is actually paid. But then you don't want to start applying the interest, because that could potentially... affect the relationship. Of course, if things get ugly at whatever point of the project, you never want them to get ugly, then there are, you know, lawyers in place that can, you know, step in and help us. But I feel like if you ever get to that point, then the relationship with your client, it's basically ruined. So we never want to get to that point. But maybe like a gentle nudge after we issue the invoice, after a couple of weeks, you know, and just remind them, you know, people are busy as well. Mm. And maybe they just put it on the back burner. So a gentle nudge.
Any other tips for you, Anna?
Well, just from the outset, and I think this is probably, I came from agency land before becoming an interior designer. So I'd worked in Adland, I'd worked in digital design agencies, event design agencies, and worked in a production company that made documentaries and programming for the BBC, who were a very late payer. So I'd always had experience in every company I'd ever worked at the difficulties of getting paid. So I just set a rule from the beginning that there's an upfront payment, that no project starts without an upfront deposit payment. No work starts. We don't mobilize a team until we know that we are in the money and that we are working into that first invoice. And then let's say there's a midpoint invoice or a staged payment that is sent with enough time for it to be able to be paid, so that we're never in arrears on a payment, apart from the final 10% at the end, not completion. But that's the only invoice that we try and allow to be in arrears, that makes sense, so that we are actually in charge of our cash flow. Otherwise, it can be so difficult to manage. Having said all of that, occasionally we'll have projects where clients pay well and according to that philosophy for a long time, and then suddenly they have, you obviously have cash flow issues. Everybody does, don't they? And they'll just stop paying. But we kind of feel that's, again, it's that difficult moment of, do you down tools and stop the project? Do you stop working on the project? Or do you just try and behind the scenes jostle to get paid? Really tricky, tricky moment on a project. In most cases, we've been paid. In some cases, we haven't. And we have had to pursue. And we have then been paid because we've had to say, well, we will need to take this to the next level. But obviously that then gets in the way of the relationship. We managed to get through to the end of some projects, even when we've had that issue. But it's tricky, but there's just a principle there, isn't there? If we've delivered well and we've delivered an amazing project, it's absolutely only fair that we get paid. And we have done a few projects in the Middle East, a couple of projects, and it was much more difficult to get paid. And we did have a 7-month period of not being paid, but having demands to carry on with the project. So we did down tools on that project, which was really tricky. Mm. Whereas I know that some other designers who work a lot in the region have said that they've just worked that into their business modus operandi, that they will not be paid for X amount of time. Whereas we try to avoid that if we can. It's tricky.
Very hard.
Best ways to make sure that you're not out of pocket? I mean, you talked about your love of spreadsheets, so I presume you're an accountant at heart, really.
No, like Hannah said, we invoice up front. Our invoicing is always up front. We do a larger mobilization fee to kick off the project, and that, you know, puts our minds at ease for a while. But even with that, sometimes clients, I've had a couple of clients that contested that and didn't want to pay us up front. And, you know, it comes down to whether you want to work with us. This is how we work. Mm-hmm. And we have, in order to run the business and to make sure that the business is safe and successful, that's we operate. So we always invoice up front.
Kind of goes back to that. What did you call it? A chemistry call that you have?
Yeah, we do a chemistry call. And then at the beginning, it's probably like a 30-minute, 45-minute call with a client. And then after that, we do a discovery meeting, whether this is in our studio or on site. And then we spend a little bit longer with them.
So you're kind of working out the psychology. But what are they going to be like to pay us as well?
You try it to the best of your ability. You can never predict everything. And one of my colleagues used to say back in the day, they're always nice in the beginning and they become tricky halfway through. You know, it's not always the case. But, you know, every project is really unique and you have to use your common sense. A lot of those things. A lot of instinct and a lot of common sense with these clients.
If we think back to situations where we have had issues, there was a little inkling that maybe we were seduced by the project, you know, how cool it's going to be. And you know, often even with a few of these grits, we have got through and we've still stayed friends on the other side, but there were a few little signs. So it is following instinct. Oh, and to your point, you know, we have occasionally had clients who we've never paid a designer up front, and we're certainly not paying 30 or 50% of the fee up front. And we've just called the bluff and just said, that's the basis upon which you would work with us. We're prepared to not do the job.
But I've had a client bring that up throughout the project.
All the way through?
All the way through the project. And every invoice. And he would remind me, you're the only consultant that is invoicing up front. The architect is not doing it. The other. And I'm like, I can't really comment on how other people run their businesses. But I've worked in interior design for a long time. And most of the interior design studios will charge up front because they have to cover their overheads and their staff and everything.
You need to protect them. You need to make sure that.
And it's in the client's best interest that we are safe as a business, because otherwise, what happens if, you know, things don't go well and they lose their interior designers because they don't want to pay them?
And do you put all this in your fee proposals?
Yes, we have a business terms and conditions, more of the legal document, let's say, but then often most of the time we'll use the BOID Reva and contact services that will reference our own business T&Cs within it. But then we also have what's called, I think it's sexily called, practicalities and logistics document. And it lists it's a bit like a Q&A, the things that go wrong, the things that need to be thought about beforehand. Or, you know, designating in a couple who's going to be the lead. You know, is there a lead? Is it whoever's the main breadwinner or who's paying? Or actually designate someone that in the absence of the two of you being around, who's allowed to make it call a decision to us and for that to stick? Mm. You know, what happens if you can't decide on something? We'll give a little scenario. This could be how we would handle it. I mean, but down to, you know, if you want to do procurement, you have to be prepared to be in from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. And we won't be receiving calls if you're not in and it's bounced. You know, you would need to handle it, all things. Oh, products need to be checked for defects, liability. I just have a huge document that obviously you can't go through all of it with the client, but it's just here and there you might pull it back up and say, this is the reason we put this in. If you remember, we chatted about this at the beginning, but let's revisit it. Now we're at this stage. But there are always things you add, always situations and learnings. Always.
We never stop learning.
Never stop.
Mm.
Okay.
So the last one then.
Go for it.
What is the best piece of advice you would give to a designer when starting out with a new client, Anna?
Best piece of advice to just really try and get to know them. But more importantly than anything, feel confident that you're a good fit. Because if you're not a good fit as a personality dynamic with your client, and that doesn't mean to say you have to be best friends with people or to be someone that you would be naturally friends with, but you do need to feel comfortable with each other and inspired in some way, or that you can enjoy the process together. Because I found over the years that if anything's wrong, if there's any disconnect, you don't share the same creative vision, you don't like the same style, your way, someone's blunt, you're too sensitive. If something's off, it will be a huge issue through the life of the project and it won't be a successful project. So actually above anything else, even fees, even the scope of works, if there's something not, if you feel there's some disconnect there, use your instinct and don't pursue.
Andrea, what would be your piece of advice?
My piece of advice would be, first of all, believe in yourself, because I find that a lot of creatives suffer from real imposter syndrome because we do something that we love and how did we end up doing this? Maybe we're not quite good enough. Maybe it was luck. So just believe in yourself and know that you're a professional, you're an expert, and you have a lot that you're bringing to the table. Invest time to get to know the other person. The interior design client relationship is a long-term relationship that can last about 2 years. And you have to make sure that the relationship is going to work, and just be honest and be transparent and keep that line of communication always open.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. Honestly, Andrea and Anna, it's just been what a joy. I've learned so much. And a brilliant conversation.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks so much, Anna. Thank you, Andrea. It's been fascinating listening to that. An excellent discussion with many great pieces of advice. So thank you so much. We do hope you've enjoyed this episode. And please do get in touch on our social channels at Interior Design Business Pod and give us feedback. The Interior Design Business is a Wildwood Plus production.